With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
So if you would ask me, what is my number one goal with any of my leaders, right, that I coach? And I would say deepen your self-awareness, connect the dots, and create magic.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated, or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. What do you want out of your work? What do you want? My guest today and I both coach top executives and rising professionals, and we find there's a core theme that drives them: performance and thriving. Think of that as having an impact in delivering results and having meaningful professional and personal growth. Today, the focus is neuroscience, specifically what it tells us about the brain-body connection and how we can utilize that knowledge so we can thrive amid times of uncertainty, change, and fear. My guest today is Julia Bunyatov, executive and leadership coach. She draws heavily from neuroscience and has written thought-provoking articles on applications of neuroscience to coaching and leadership, particularly in an increasingly AI-powered world. Julia Bunyatov is a certified executive coach and founder of Surmayo, Inc. In addition to her neuroscience-informed coaching, she draws on 30 years of leadership experience, including C-suite roles and board service, to help executives and their teams. And some of her current work explores how predictive brain science and emotional forecasting shape leadership in an AI-powered world. Julia, welcome to 97% Effective. Excited to have you on today.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Thrilled to be here.
Awesome. I have known you, okay, as a coach, and we've known each other for years. But preparing for this interview, I didn't fully appreciate that close to two decades, by my count, like looking at your LinkedIn, on Wall Street, Bankers Trust, Lehman Brothers, Barclays, I mean, in some fixed income and equity derivatives, right? You know, that's pretty intense areas. So I wanted to know, you know, that transition into coaching, but also how that training or Wall Street experience shapes or comes up for you in your work today.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for taking me all the way back, what is it, 14 years since I left Wall Street, But yeah, I agree. I've had a fantastic run in financial services. I led teams in finance, risk management, and in trading. And I was a chief operating officer for global equities trading and global equity derivatives. And I think to this day, when I think about my career in corporate, I would say that it was probably one of the most memorable experiences in terms of just getting crazy, important, and exciting stuff done and working with incredible people and leading teams through change, right? Through tremendous change. Like you've mentioned companies that don't exist anymore. So you could imagine the context. And yeah, so that was in 2011. I left in 2011. Even in my work today as a coach, I always appreciate that foundation because I've been in that space in a way that I'm still seeking that space of performance. You brought in that word. And however, my training now and my life since then has taught me so much in terms of resilience and that concept of thriving. Mm.
And then where does the interest in neuroscience, it's really hot now, right? But you've been interested in that field for years. When we first did some of our work together at Columbia, you were already well-versed in neuroscience. So where did that interest come from?
Yeah. I had some like deep reflection recently. So how did I start getting curious about how we operate and what is that sweet spot of thriving? It happened right after I left work. My family went through a personal experience, tragic experience, I would say. And in that moment, I've chosen a path. I saw that I could choose two different paths, and I've chosen one that defined my life thereafter. And I could say that the life that is truly thriving life. And that question, it wasn't easy. It was super hard. But that question, why did I choose that versus the other, was probably the beginning of my interest and curiosity. I've then become a certified yoga teacher. I've explored trading in a hedge fund capacity. And like, what does it mean for us to really optimize our emotional state? Mm. What are the emotions? Are the emotions standing in front of us to achieve our results? Are they really the conduit to create incredible outcomes? And then I would probably attribute myself coaching is to my children. My son inspired me to be a coach. He's dyslexic. So around that time when I left work, I became super involved in the board work. I was on the board of International Dyslexia Association, and I was introducing educational frameworks for teachers to help them understand how we learn and develop, that it's really an individual process, that not everyone learns and develops in the same way. So that I would think it was 2014 when I kind of learned more about the brain and what makes my special son tick in many ways, and what is the environment for him to thrive, and including the classroom environment, right? So there was a lot of exploration to create the best environment for my children in a way. And yeah, and then I went back into my industry in 2018 to lead the effort, the creating of the effort, Women in the CEO Community, given I was a CEO in the past. And through those experiences and conversations in the coffee shop, someone said, oh, you're such a great listener. You helped me connect the dots. Can you be my coach? And I was like, a coach? What does it mean? So, and I explored what could I do to become an executive coach, a certified executive coach, but I didn't connect with the cognitive training. So I thought I'm going to study neuroscience, and I became certified in neuroscience. I am glad that you mentioned that neuroscience right now is a buzzword. I think it became a buzzword as a result of a silver lining of the pandemic, when all of us had to learn and adapt in many ways very rapidly. We kind of thought, how do we really do that organically? How do we optimize what we know about our neurobiology so we could enjoy, in a way, the process that we had no control over? So yeah, that was my entry point, and Columbia came after, and then you and I met.
Thank you for sharing that. And you've touched on a theme that we are definitely going to talk about, this, the idea of choosing to thrive? And how do you optimize your environment, things about yourself, the brain-body connection? So I'm glad that you have touched on all those things. Let me ask you too, Surmayo. I did not have time to research what that name is. I'd never heard of that name. What is it? How did you choose or the name? It's very unique for your company.
Thank you. It's a team effort. My husband and I, we were exploring a strength-related element. So that is connected to different elements that we have in nature. So Surmayo is actually a promontory in Italy. Oh. So it's a piece of land that extends into the ocean, and it's an elevated piece of land. So in a way, it's a rock. So I really resonated with the concept of air, water, land, and an elevated land that is standing strong and notwithstanding anything that comes its way. So yeah, there is a place actually in Italy that you could trace it to.
Okay, I'm going to look that up. It sounds like a very powerful image. Yeah, cool name for a company that says a lot.
Thank you.
And so let's dive into this. And what I really like is you follow all the research, you do some yourself, but a lot of it is how it is applied, how we take those insights and apply them to help in our leadership and our coaching and ourselves. And so for our interview here, I want to focus on two parts: applications of neuroscience on our leadership and coaching, and then talk about this. You wrote a great article that kicked off, you know, the lead up to the Columbia conference on coaching about implications of AI. For some context, when you're working with your clients, C-suite execs, most of those high pressure, high stakes environment, not unlike what you were describing, right, in your career. When they come, we talk about kind of the presenting issue, why they first engage you or want to engage you. What's kind of typical with you when you're coaching them?
Yeah, and I think it's getting increasingly topical. How do we lead through complexity? Mm. How do we lead through complexity and lead an organization where we create commercial value and also retain operational resilience, right? Mm. So, and if we use the old neuroscience framework, you could say, how do you integrate your right and left brain effectively and create value for the shareholders? And I think that is like a cornerstone to anything and everything. And you could say, yeah, so it's complex to lead an organization in today's times, but also how do we lead with clarity, knowing what's important? And I don't want to use that word because the brain is always listening, and hopefully we'll discuss that as well. Mm. But I will use it. How do we not get overwhelmed, right?
Mm. Yeah.
How do we lead with clarity and achieve what we know that is required? In any way, if we know what the brain is capable of, how do we create outcomes that we couldn't have predicted before, which is the definition of innovation?
Mm. Given that they come with, hey, we need to manage through this complexity, embedded in that is, how are we doing this in a way that enables us to thrive? You wrote a great article in Choice, which is a coaching journal and magazine. We chose for simplicity here in our discussion to focus on, you know, three core areas that you've called out that are really essential to being able to thrive and manage and work through that complexity, which are mindfulness, optimism, and curiosity. So love to discuss these in turn. As soon as I say mindfulness, optimism, and curiosity, you know, you get the yoga kumbaya California thing out
Sorry.
There. So I know there is deep science here, and you're working with executives who, if you're just floating around saying feel good stuff, you will not last long working with them. So let's start with mindfulness. It is a word that totally gets overused.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned what you did, because it's 100% true. And that is, yet again, describes how the language defines our experience and how resonate with the meaning of that experience, right? So yeah, mindfulness is really, my definition of mindfulness is twofold. One is our ability to manage our attention and focus in a desired way.
Very simple, compact, I love it.
Very simple. And then the other one, our ability to also observe what's happening in a non-judgmental way. So one, number one is focus the attention. And another one, be okay with what is, right? Or what is it? Be fully present. So both of them are essential. And both of them are essential for self-awareness. So if you would ask me, what is my number one goal with any of my leaders, right, that I coach? And I would say there are like, what is it? Three definitions. Deepen your self-awareness, connect the dots, and create magic. And some people don't resonate with the word magic, but we use a different word.
What's the other word?
Create what you desire.
So it's that state of being more aware, being more present, being less judgmental. For the audience out there, how do they know if they're in that state or not? And then what are some examples of how to become more mindful? What does it look like?
Yeah, and you could create a practice. Absolutely. Practice is always very helpful. Meditation practice. But you don't have to have a meditation practice. I argue that what we do in a coaching conversation is also a practice of mindfulness. So our ability to peel the onion and be okay with what shows up, I could see that in a client if they're able to look deeper, and that we're able to look deeper when we are non-judgmental about what's showing up, right? So in a way, that's a beautiful gauge. And then the practice of mindfulness could be as simple as spending some time in nature and observing what's happening around you and activating your sensory data. So listening to the sounds of music could be fantastic, and fully immersing in that experience, listening to the sounds of birds, observing a tree, so activating your visual capacity. That is a process of mindfulness, which is you're engaged in an activity where you're fully immersed in that experience and there is no chatter in your brain.
So a lot of it is focusing. So me prior to 100%. This, I'm hitting the pool, I'm doing laps, I'm just focusing on my breathing and looking at the line as I go 100%. Lap to lap. That is a way of getting your brain to be in that state.
100%. And I'm glad you brought up breath, because breath is essential and it's all available to us in any moment. A simple breath exercise could even shift your nervous system from sympathetic to parasympathetic and help you to stay present. So breath work is absolutely beautiful for us to lean on.
And do you get much resistance to this? I mean, I'm thinking of a banker type. I'm thinking of an alpha, right? Who's like, oh, I'm paying you to like tell me to like go meditate. Do you get some of that resistance?
I would never tell my client go meditate. Mm-hmm. I think I will invite them to the process with me in a coaching space to feel that process in their body. Mm-hmm. When they're non-judgmental, showing up what's happening for them and how much more integrated they feel as a result. Mm-hmm. And that coaching conversation, right, an hour to 90 minutes, could show them already neurobiologically what could happen to them when they show up what is. And many of my high achieving clients, they already have a practice. So these are very sophisticated type clients, right? So, but again, unless you experience that in your body and you feel, oh my God, I feel great, right? You're never going to go and do it. And I think that's, for me, in a way, that's the definition of thriving as well, right? Yeah. So change could happen the hard way. Let me go and start doing it every day. Or the easy way, I felt it in the body. I know how it feels. And I want to replicate that feeling. And that feeling of fully present, being fully present, available, what's showing up for you, and being able to choose in the moment what the right outcome is just an incredible experience.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
Talk about this too, right? So we think about mindfulness as being chill, being present, okay? Almost the opposite of being in a stressful situation or experiencing stress where your mind is racing, your body feels it. How does this work together? Because to be totally chill is just almost impossible all the time. And there's good research that says you do want some stress, right? The stress kind of motivates you to think through things as maybe a forcing function. I'm simplifying this. How does mindfulness work with wanting to have stress or some stress being good?
Yeah, totally. And you already kind of, you kind of showed me two extremes and you defined the middle, right? Mm. So being chill on the yoga mat, even though if you do the yoga practice the right way, it's never chill. It's more so work, right? It's a mindfulness practice in its own versus being in a stress environment. These are two extremes. So you do want to be in the middle, right? And what does the middle look like is when things are very uncertain, you have crystal clear clarity, what's important, and you know exactly where do you start, right? So you're able to see what's happening, and you're able to effectively prioritize what's the first thing that you need to focus on.
Okay.
So that is the definition of bringing that practice into the workplace. Mm.
And that feeds into, right, so you've talked about mindfulness as this foundation of the state you need to be in, create self-awareness, ability to make choices. Talk about the second piece, which is optimism, that you've call that being very important, being optimistic. Sounds very American, right? I'm out here in Europe. But what do you mean by optimism?
And I would probably use a different sequence, Michael. Okay. I would say mindfulness is our ability to stay with what is and being able to see what's happening and prioritize effectively. One thing on mindfulness that I haven't mentioned, there is fantastic research that shows that that practice truly helps us to connect with our essence or our sense of self and our values. So I don't know, when you're doing your laps in the pool, you're probably able to connect with what truly is important and you feel mostly alive, right? So that is, I would say, is like, what did I say? The ability to focus the attention, be non-judgmental to our experience, and also connect with what's really important. So that is probably the third and very important facet of the practice of mindfulness. And I would say the next one, if we know what's truly important because we're really able to be present with what's showing up and connect with what's important to us, then the next one is curiosity, I would say, right?
Yeah.
Like then the question becomes, and as you remember from our Columbia teaching, our professor was so intelligent in bringing that frame, anxiety versus curiosity, right? When things are happening and they're happening fast, and we could talk about the brain at this moment if you'd like. It's easy to go into anxious state, right? It's very easy to be disoriented, and the brain science describes why that happens. However, we could non-judgmentally show up for that experience. So be aware, not negated, but mostly be non-judgmental and aware and understand that this is normal for us to feel that way, and then get curious about the opportunity during that moment. So when we get curious, we engage our capacity to be creative and innovative,
right?
So curiosity might look like, what's the opportunity? As simple as such, what is the opportunity in this situation? So you probably did your laps in the pool, and then you walked out and you thought, oh my God, what's the opportunity today when I speak to Julia, right?
Exactly.
Right? And opportunity could be endless. We could continue that conversation again, right? So so it's very expansive. And that is engaging curiosity. But we could only engage curiosity if we non-judgmentally show up for the fact that we could be disoriented in the moment of change. Mm. And that is the practice of mindfulness.
And so, again, take this to kind of a practical level, like there's conflicts at work, right, with other individuals. And so if you're mindful, you're present, you're non-judgmental, how do you turn that curiosity when someone's like attacking you? Most people want to fight, will trigger the anxious brain, particularly in certain alpha environments that are very negative. Is there a practical way to shift into that that you would,
of course,
call out?
Yeah. So if we would engage mindfulness, so an understanding why we feel a certain way, like you use the word trigger, so non-judgmentally showing up for that experience and say it's normal that I feel that way. Mm. And so we're acknowledging and validating our experience. So that's the practice of mindfulness. And then after that, we probably have to set an intention. What's my goal with that conversation? What's my intention with that relationship? What would I like to happen for myself and that other person? So that is a system. So what are we doing? We create in a systemic perspective. So first system perspective would be our own internal. That's the practice of mindfulness. The second one would be my relationship with that individual. How do I want that relationship to play out? And the third one would be the system of outcome for the organization. Mm. What do I really want to happen as a result of us having that conversation and hopefully collaborating and creating an outcome that is generative for the organization? Mm.
So it's the ability to hold all those things and think through them and evaluate how you want to proceed, follow up.
100%. 100%. And that is from that place of curiosity. Fundamentally from the place of mindfulness, of acknowledging what's showing up for us, attending to what's happening to us, deepening our self-awareness, and showing up for that experience non-judgmentally and empathetically. So empathy is first self-directed, from my perspective, and just the practice of mindfulness is an empathetic experience because you're not judging that experience, you're just observing it. And empathy is a generative emotion that creates more energy in the brain-body system. Mm. So that is, there is a neuroscience research that fully supports that. For many years, I think in many ways, we always think of empathy towards others, but we can't do that without doing it for ourselves. Mm. And that, again, is the practice of that Wuru word, mindfulness.
Mm. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so if we're able to do that effectively for ourselves and in a way that is the process of coaching, right? This is what we do with our client, right? We're showing up for them and we're acknowledging what's happening through their experience and how that might feel for them. Then they create more brain-body energy to attend to a broader system, a system of another constituent in that particular conversation that you brought up. And if they're able to see that the other person has their own perspective, then we set the intention there. And then ultimately you want to connect with the system of the outcome.
We tend to think of the brain as kind of just reacting, okay, and then it does things. But you've written an idea that I hadn't seen, talking about research, that the brain is this supercomputer, the human one, that it actually is predicting, and this idea of prediction error. Can you say more about that? Because that's a concept that I didn't totally understand, but it seems quite important here.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're bringing that up because that is probably the most important aspect of the brain that if you would ask me, what do I share with clients, if anything, at all around neuroscience, I might share that, right? Because that fundamentally changes how we think around there is almost an agency, a call to action. If we know that fact, right, then it's kind of, oh my God, this is so amazing. That's what I mean. Deepening self-awareness and connecting the dots. That is part of that connecting the dots stage, which is, yes, exactly. The brain is continuously predicting what's going to happen from a moment-to-moment basis. It does it based on our past experiences of what we've experienced in the past in different contexts, obviously through our lived experiences, through childhood, adolescence, and definitely through work experience. And then it does that prediction is essential because what the brain constantly does, it allocates energy throughout the body. So that's the most important function of the brain. It's there to keep us alive, to survive, to thrive. I would add that third word, to thrive, because what does it do? It allocates energy across all our organs, right? That is just a fundamental truth. And the way it does that process, it needs to know how much energy is required from us from a moment-to-moment basis. So what things are constant and things are great and nothing's happening, we're feeling great because everything is working smoothly in terms of our brain-body system. But the minute uncertainty enters the system of our existence, what the brain does, it doesn't know what the next moment will be, and it doesn't know how much energy it will need to keep us alive, to survive, to thrive. So, and it manages that process from that prediction error, that the definition of that gap between what the brain thinks we need from moment to moment to where we think the uncertainty happened, that gap, it's prediction error. So the minute the brain is uncertain how much energy we need, we feel anxious. So that prediction error of the brain not knowing how much energy we need is anxiety. So the best way to eliminate that prediction error is through experience. Experience creates dopamine in our system, so we feel good and we feel more motivated. And what is experience? So let's say on a Friday night, let's say we're in winter, and on a Friday night, someone is, we know that there will be a huge snowstorm, and we might have a power outage, so we're getting anxious. So what could we do? We could either go and prepare for the power storm, right? Do the groceries, making sure you have a generator, et cetera. Or you could just sit tight. So Monday comes, there is no snowstorm, and you feel a relief. So that relief, even though you haven't done anything, is part of the experience. But also, if you've done something on Friday to prepare, you also felt the relief. So it's your choice when you feel the relief. When you've gone through the weekend and there was no snowstorm and you came out clean and you feel relief, or you've done something to prepare. So the argument in my article, the first article that you referenced, that when uncertainty hits, if we're able to sit what is, right? And using the work of mindfulness, if we understand what's happening, right? We have clarity around the situation. We could make a decision to make the most out of that experience. So that decision is an experience and an action in itself. So me deciding that I'm going to thrive through the snowstorm and have a fantastic weekend is going to make me feel great, and I'm going to have a fantastic weekend. And that is such an essential step, because that is a decision. But you could only make that decision, and if you're fully able to sit with what is and have a full clarity around the situation, which is the practice of mindfulness. And in the leadership context, also know what's important. Again, the practice of mindfulness that takes you to the essence of what's truly important to us.
And by taking that action, essentially, you're bringing in new data, which I guess updates the brain, or kind of rewires it to think more widely about options, again, because that then becomes part of your past experience. Is that a way of kind of rewiring and opening the experience to
yeah, first of all, 100%. First of all, it eliminates the error. So anxiety goes away. And your brain-body system has now more energy that it could direct to that curiosity, creativity, and innovation to potentially have a blast during that snowstorm weekend. Or if in context of our clients, create something that didn't exist before when uncertainty happens, because they chose that they're going to look at it as a tremendous opportunity versus being in an anxious state. So yeah, absolutely. We have clients, you and I, both of us, right, that come in with the context of anxious state. So how do we help them to self-regulate, to help them in the coaching conversation to get to that curious state is 100% essential.
Yeah.
That's probably fundamentally what we do is one of the most important, including deepening self-awareness. One of the most important things we do as coaches. And then helping them, supporting them in kind of say, what is the opportunity, but then what is that outcome that I desire and how do I get there?
And to go back to optimism, right? We talked about mindfulness and curiosity. How does optimism fit in here? Because you had called that out as well as being quite important.
Yeah, and that would be the third, right? Mm-hmm. So if we are able to sit with what is, if we're able to understand what's important and look at it from a perspective of opportunity, we absolutely need to believe into our ability to create an incredible outcome. So optimism is here, not the toxic positivity that comes with the word that you said, Americans are optimistic.
Say more about toxic positivity. It was the first time I'd heard that used. But yeah, this notion of like, hey, be positive, be optimistic. This is, a more nuanced way of thinking about optimism. So
it is. Yeah. And it is if we believe that prediction error is eliminated by action. So optimism in itself without action and without creating an outcome is useless, right? So that's the word I would probably use. So this ability to believe in our abilities to create outstanding outcome comes with a lot of language, and that assumes that there is a lot of activation, agency, and action. So optimism is a very active word. I prefer that word to the word confidence, because confidence in absence of an action is also a quite useless word. So what is confidence? It is our ability to believe that we're able to create something that is outstanding, that it's great for your family or for your organization, for your team, and maybe in a way that did not exist before, which is the definition of innovation.
So this optimism, confidence really needs to be paired with the idea of taking some action, thought through action that helps create kind of this feedback loop, rewiring.
100%. Rewiring, and also action then leads to behavior leads to skill, right? So we say mindfulness as a trait, right? Meaning that the more you do it, the more it becomes part of your being. You don't need to think much about it. Curiosity as a trait. How do you activate that through that it's just your state of being, right? And absolutely the same about optimism.
Let's shift here to the last part, right? You've talked about these neuroscience applications, and the article that really impressed me, and I forwarded that out to people because it really, you want to read it multiple times, is now the massive emergence of AI. People are worried about it. They're reacting quickly to it. I love that article and wanted to talk about a particular piece of it, which is this idea you said with new technology that comes along, and particularly AI, almost what we just talked about, right? There's an anxious part, right? This is going to replace me, get very reactive. But you suggested instead that we should be reflective. And so say more about this, of how we want to be thinking about our role in an AI world.
Yeah, and I think in a way it summarizes many things we've discussed. So, and I would probably start. So this idea of prediction error is a definition of emotion. Like our ability to predict, our brain's ability to predict is the definition of that emotion. So we are anxious, we are running a huge prediction error. So how do we shift into opportunity? So it's the same thought process. And how do we leverage AI in a productive and incredible way? Because to think that it could do crazy things is very easy as well, right? So, and science fiction had proven us, right? And sometimes it's scary to even think about science fiction that it comes true, right? So whatever the brain imagines then somehow comes true. Again, it's neuroscience. It's fascinating. What is the agency for us here when we have such a technology that we can't really wait too long? We have to be, there is a call to action for all of us as leaders. How do we partner and collaborate and create something that didn't exist before? And it, for different leaders, it means different contexts, and it's still in conversations in many rooms. What are we doing, right?
Yeah.
How could we do it more effectively? Is it all about creating efficiencies in the workplace? Absolutely, everyone is discussing that. But more importantly, how are we changing as leaders? How are we changing our mindsets?
Right.
And what does it mean for the new model of cross-generational development and leadership, right? This word of apprenticeship. This article created a lot of conversation, and I'm so happy to see that from different folks, from Microsoft, from Capgemini, everyone is contributing, COOs in financial services, our scholars. Like, what is the opportunity that we have here is really, really fascinating.
There were clearly those who were, the sky is falling, anxious, replacing. This idea of seeing the opportunity, I think, has kind of reframed the conversation in terms of how can it supplement, amplify, enable. And as you're talking about this, I mean, your article did make this plea to, hey, let's slow down and think about that, exactly what we talked about right in the middle part of our conversation. But you brought up this idea, and I really want to call this out because everyone's talking, right, you know, about like, let's reduce friction. Things are quicker, right? It's how we sell more. It's how the social media companies work. I felt like you were saying we need to increase some friction because that will get us to think about it. This is how we actually learn. So talk more about this idea of friction that you introduced.
Yeah, friction or uncertainty, right? How do we deal with when we are unclear around how to proceed? Like, what is our process? Do we eliminate that friction without thinking about it, or do we embrace that? Because the change happens when things are hard, right? Going back to my experience when it was super hard for me to stay present and to kind of say, I'm going to go through it. But if you do that courageously, if you're able to do that courageously, right, and you come out on the other side, it's just incredible. So friction is just part of the way we learn and develop, right? And it's essential for us to evolve. And it is connected to the prediction era and how do we optimize energy. In my training, there is a concept of relaxed physiological state, a state of alertness that helps us achieve incredible results. And I do think that there is, like, yes, that state is absolutely essential. But the component of stress, something that we discussed before, right, it creates that lever for us that we're able to perform even higher. So it's not just the mindfulness and it's not stress when we're anxious, but it's something in the middle. It's in the middle where we're able to have clarity and ability to prioritize effectively. And that is not simple. It could be simple, right? If it's a skill, but it's in the beginning, it's not simple. It's disorienting, and that is friction.
Well, you've certainly opened up a lot of conversation around this topic and ideas that got me thinking even more on the third read. I love that versus being kind of spoon-fed, here's the answer, because you do raise more questions in there, but really thoughtfully look at it. As a question, I mean, you have been looking at AI, you've been following this. Is there a way that you use it at all in your coaching practice?
I don't use it in a coaching practice, but I use it for myself 100%. Mm. Not yet. I'm waiting for our Columbia conference.
Okay.
To eliminate my thinking about using it in my coaching practice, but I definitely partner with AI.
Okay. When you say using it for yourself, is that administrative or in other capacities?
Everything that I do in terms of content, in terms of even email writing, I leverage AI all the time.
Yeah. Julia, I will ask the question here, which I like to ask. Was there anything here that you were surprised that I didn't ask that I should have?
Oh, that's a great question. Maybe talking a little bit more about emotions.
Mm. And anything since that is a important piece that you just want to bring up related to emotions, get people to think about?
That they're a source of energy and they're a fantastic conduit to achieve our results.
Mm. And is the idea there not to suppress our emotions, but to pay attention to them, even utilize them towards 100%. All these things, particularly the curiosity element that you talked about?
100%. Leverage them as data and transform them into the energy that helps us achieve our goals. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to come back on for another podcast and talk more deeply about emotions. We covered a lot of ground here, Julia. Fantastic conversation. Again, Julia Bunyatov, founder and coach, Surmayo. What is the best way for people to see you, connect with you, learn about your coaching and what you do?
LinkedIn is probably the best, and my website, surmayocoaching.com.
Mm. Fantastic, Julia. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.